this other announcement, if you haven't seen it, we've got staying with us for a few days Dr. Ann Radwan from the University of Northern Florida in Jacksonville. She's working with the U.S. Information Agency and is on a tour of the Middle East studying or evaluating overseas foreign institutes. And she will be talking on the subject of women in academia, academics as women, at the American Center on this coming Sunday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Also, you might recall that at the beginning of the series, I told you there might be a little bit of reshuffling of the lectures since people's plans change. The next lectures coming up were to be given by Sherry Lenzen, who is an archaeologist that's will be working at Pella this spring, and she's also worked at Abila on some surveys of Islamic, Byzantine and Islamic sites in Jordan. She went back to the States at Christmas time to finish up her dissertation and prepare for her defense. Evidently, she's had her defense, but has been delayed a little bit. We got a telegram from her a few days ago saying she'd be back the 28th instead of the 21st. So she will be giving her lectures, but probably a week later than they're scheduled in the schedule that you have. What we're going to try to do tonight, very quickly, is finish up the slides that we were looking at, briefly talking about the archaeological periods represented in Jordan, and then we'll go on to a very brief survey or summary of the history of archaeological work in Jordan, and then start in a discussion of how a person chooses a site and chooses a staff and coordinates things with the Department of Antiquities. I realize that some of that, especially after being more talked to me tonight, said go over that quickly because we aren't too interested in that. It is a little bit more technical. But I think it is important to help you to understand what all is involved in getting a project off the ground and what kind of requirements a person should meet. I should say, too, that it is commonly characteristic of archaeologists not to be too concerned about that. They want to get out in the field and start digging, and it creates a lot of problems because they don't get their paperwork or their pre-date planning done in order. Okay, so we'll kill the lights and hopefully get through the slides in just a few minutes. Yeah, could you knock those lights off there? If you do have any specific questions about the slides, please raise your voice because I can't see hands and I'll be going pretty quickly here. You remember we left off last time getting to talk about the Byzantine period starting around 324 when Constantine moves the capital from Rome to Constantinople, and from that point on Christianity becomes the state religion. Of course, as I tried to emphasize last time, there wasn't a dramatic shift from Roman paganism to Christianity. There was a gradual transformation, just as there was a gradual transformation at the end of the Byzantine period to Islam. This is the famous courtyard fountain at the Cathedral of Jerash, dating to about 350 AD, which seems to be the point at which Jerash becomes predominantly Christian. It's one of the few archaeological finds that we have actual historical references to. One of the most impressive Byzantine sites in Jordan is up in the north, a site called Umm al-Jamal. In fact, it's often described as a Roman site, but when you go to Umm al-Jamal, the extensive ruins you see are almost all Byzantine, late Byzantine, in fact. There's been a rather startling discovery. The ruins at Umm al-Jamal have been studied and mapped and planned since the turn of the century, but it wasn't until a couple of years ago when Dr. Bert de Vries, who was working on an ACOR project of excavating Umm al-Jamal, came across the northeastern area of Umm al-Jamal, they started looking very closely and found the very ruinous remains of an early Roman fort. So there are Roman ruins around Umm al-Jamal, and in fact there are some Nabataean inscriptions, and very often the site of Umm al-Jamal is spoken of as being founded in the Nabataean period, but up until this time, most of the Nabataean remains of Umm al-Jamal are just funerary inscriptions, indicating certainly that the Nabataeans had a presence in this region. We know that they controlled the route from Aqaba all the way up to Damascus, but it's questionable that there was any extensive occupation of Umm al-Jamal during the Nabataean period. There is, in fact, one building that's referred to in a lot of the literature as the Nabataean Temple, going back to an early description that Butler gave it in the first part of this century. The excavations at that so-called Nabataean Temple have now demonstrated that the building was originally established in the late Byzantine period. So ongoing excavations are often correcting datings of buildings and of sites which have been in the literature for 50 or 60 years. This is another example of the ruins at Umm al-Jamal, actually a private house along the eastern side of the city. Along with excavation, a lot of work is now being done in consolidation and conservation. There is a distinction between the two. As you can see, these walls are in danger of collapsing. Again, Bert de Vries is doing some excavation, but he's really concentrating on consolidating the walls, pumping cement into the walls in order to stabilize them. Umm al-Jamal may someday have some reconstruction work, although it probably will be another 20 or 30 years of consolidation before the archaeologists can even start to think about trying to put the stones back in their original place as they've done at Iraq al-Amir. Madaba, during the Byzantine period, certainly was an important area. If you have the time, sometimes several days, to go walking through Madaba, if you can get into some of the houses, you'll find that evidently, during the Byzantine period, Madaba was just carpeted with mosaics, not only in the many churches that you find around Madaba, but also private houses seem to often have had mosaics in them. The most famous mosaic, of course, in Madaba is the famous Madaba map, which is a map of Palestine. Here you see just part of it, the Dead Sea here, the Jordan River coming up, and the stylized representation of the city of Jerusalem. It's been very important because it, dating to the 7th century, about 650 BC, something like that. Whoops, 560 BC. It's the earliest actual graphic depiction that we have of the Holy Land in the Byzantine period. Of course, one of the objects of the archaeologists, and especially those who are more interested in biblical sites, is to try to find the, try to identify modern sites or tells with biblical sites. The Madaba map has been very helpful in giving the actual map location of ancient sites, although there are some problems too. As you can see, large sections of the map have been destroyed, or the mosaic have been destroyed. And there's always a question, to what extent is the Madaba map a stylization? How worried were they in terms of trying to depict the exact location of ancient sites? There's a great debate about the Dead Sea in the time that the Madaba map was made. If you look at the southern part here, you can't see the Lizan, the little peninsula that sticks out into the Dead Sea. So some people have argued on the basis of the Madaba map that during the Roman Byzantine period, the Dead Sea must have been much smaller, so that the southern basin was completely dry and the southern end was right around the Lizan. That is a possibility. Another possibility is that they just weren't that careful in the representation of the Dead Sea. Another possibility is that, in fact, right about where you would expect to see the Lizon, there is a large section of the map missing. So in fact, it could possibly have been depicted originally. The Germans especially are doing a lot of work on the Matabah map and trying to figure out identifications of ancient sites and the basis of the Matabah map. This is just another example of mosaics that you find in and around the Nebo Sioga district. Not only is the study of mosaics very useful in terms of seeing the design change, the tessera, or the small cubes that are used to make the map or the different mosaics, but very often you will get Greek inscriptions along with the mosaics, which actually date them very closely. And then, of course, if you have a church with a nice mosaic intact stratigraphically, you can see that the mosaic goes right up against the wall, and you can give a definite date sometimes to the month of the completion of the church. It's also another interesting discussion that's going on, is that to what extent were the people who produced these mosaic maps local, and to what extent are they relying upon imported labor? Also, if they are local, what about the mosaics that you find in the early Islamic period? Are they simply using the descendants of the Byzantines? And that appears to be the case. Some very nice mosaics were found out at Qasr Halabat, an early Islamic site, and there are the similarities between those mosaics and the mosaics from many churches at Jerash are really striking. There seems to be just a continuation of the tradition, local tradition of mosaic art. Once you get into the Umayyad period, which starts roughly around 661, should say at the end of the Byzantine period, that comes to an end roughly around 630 to 40. During that 10-year period, the Arabs, under the leadership of the Prophet Muhammad and his generals, invaded, and by the end of that period, by 640 AD, the entire area of Jordan was under the control of the Arabs. It was then a great earthquake took place around 747. You'll often hear references to that massive earthquake, which damaged Jerash extensively, and in fact almost all of the sites around The Umayyad period starts around 660. It comes to an end shortly after the devastating earthquake of 747. Most sites that were occupied during the Byzantine period continue in occupation during the Umayyad period, but on a much reduced scale. There seems to be a gradual decline. The Umayyad caliphs were centered in Damascus, so Jordan was still a fairly important trade route between Damascus and Egypt and Arabia to the south. Whereas in the Byzantine period, Jordan seems to have been rather densely occupied. Almost every place you go in Jordan, you can pick up Byzantine pottery. Umayyad pottery is much found not in much less abundance, although it often is found at Byzantine sites. One of the confusions also in trying to identify Umayyad pottery is that the period is rather short, roughly 100 years long, and certainly a lot of the local pottery traditions from the Byzantine period spilled in or were continued into the Umayyad period. So often there is a debate when you find what is clearly very late Byzantine pottery, whether in fact it dates from the late Byzantine or the early Umayyad period. The most distinctive remains from the Umayyad period are the so-called desert castles. That's a little bit misleading because the different desert castles did not serve as fortresses in general. They had different functions. This is Qasr Qurana, which is to the east of Amman, and it is clearly a caravanserai, right in the middle of a lot of trade routes that pass through the desert, Kasr Amra, this being a short distance, about 20 kilometers to the northeast. Remember in the first lecture that we were showing slides, we talked a little bit about the prehistoric or flint site, mainly Upper Paleolithic, Epipaleolithic at Piranha. That is shown very clearly in this aerial photograph as this dark patch not far from the Kasr Piranha. That's another close-up view of Kasr Piranha. There has been, of course, some restoration of the Kasr by the Department of Antiquities, but even before that restoration took place, it was actually in quite an amazing state of preservation. The good state of preservation of these particular ruins, of course, is due in large part to the fact that they are so isolated. That's one of the problems that we have in many of the antiquity sites in Jordan, is that sites are continuously occupied so that you have modern villages placed on top of ancient sites, and when that happens, there's a lot of robbing of the stones for making newer buildings. These are isolated enough that that's not the case. Kasr Amra, as I say, between Azraq and Kasr Piranha. Also an Umayyad palace, but whereas the Kasr Piranha appears to be a caravansary, a point where caravans would pass through and stop over, have a safe spot to camp, Kasr Amra appears to be much more of a health spa or palace for one of the Umayyad caliphs. It has a bath inside it, very similar to the Roman bath that we looked at last time that was excavated at Salt this last year. Also, an interesting thing about Kasr Amra is, as you know, in Islam there is fairly strong prohibitions against graven images and so forth. At Kasr Amra you have beautiful paintings of animals, of human figures, actually rather risque pictures of women, which certainly wouldn't have been tolerated in the later period of Islam, but it seems that during that Umayyad period, the depiction of human and animal figures was not as strong a prohibition, or at least not here in Jordan, as it was later. This is Kasr Mashata, which is located very near the new Alia Airport, just off the desert highway. It had a beautiful facade around what's a large perimeter wall that was unfortunately chopped up in pieces and sent to Germany around the first of the century, and then destroyed in some of the bombings in Berlin. There's clear evidence that the Kasr, which evidently was kind of a winter palace, again, of a caliph, evidently was never completed. You can see the outline of foundations which were being laid out, but not finished. One of the things they're worried about with Mashata is that, as you can see, it is in a fairly ruinous state. It's made out of brick and not very stable. They're worried at this point, when the jumbo jets start taking off and landing, that it's going to destabilize the whole thing and probably not collapse fully, completely, but suffer further damage. This is Hammam Sarah. It's another Umayyad bath modeled on the model of the, or the pattern of the Roman baths, located just a few kilometers east of Kasr Halabat, which is, again, another Umayyad Kasr, although its history goes back to at least the Byzantine period. And this is a little bit more remote. This is Kasr Tuba, evidently also constructed right about the time that Kasr Mashash, near the airport, was constructed. And again, there is evidence that Tuba was never completed. It's not that easy to find, although once you've been there, it's not that difficult either. You have to go down near Katrana and then to the east, about 25 kilometers from the turnoff, perhaps a little more, 35. This is one Umayyad site that you may not have ever heard about. It's Qasr Mashash. I'm always confusing Mashash with Mashatta. There, as you can see, not much remaining on the surface. It's located near Qasr Harana. In fact, if it's a clear day, you can see Qasr Harana off in the distance about 20 to 25 kilometers away. The Department of Antiquities Director of Excavations, Dr. Hazi Bisha, is very interested in this particular site, not because it has a lot of monuments or high-standing architecture remaining, but because it does appear to have a very elaborate irrigation system and water collection system, very similar to what Ghazi has found up at Qasr Halabat. So he's beginning excavations of this site and will probably be continuing them for the next 5 or 6 years. Here you can see you're looking down into a well with rather well-preserved arches, and you can even see here a couple of the crossbeams, which would have been used to roof over the arches, so this would have been a closed system. This is another view of Mashesh, showing a big rectangular building, what remains the rectangular building. It's also in danger of being destroyed due to the fact that it's located right on a wadi, and when you have the winter rains in the desert, you get some rather fast-moving water, and it's cutting away at the side of the site. Okay, following the Umayyad period, the Abbasids take over. The power, center of power, moves from Damascus to Baghdad, and you find Jordan going into quite a decline. The Abbasids are then followed by the Fatimids in Egypt, and that also seems to be a decline period in Jordan. You do find some evidence around, and I think you'll find in the next year or so, as work at Jerash continues, that they're going to be turning up probably more Abbasid and Fatimid evidence than was previously considered. In fact, they've already found a gold coin from the Abbasid period in the North Theater. That's a very simple thing to say, that it's Abbasid followed by the Fatimid. In fact, there were different groups vying for power in Palestine, and it fell into one person's hand and another group's hand back and forth. But those are the two main groups. Then around the end of the 12th century, around 10, actually of the 11th century, 1099, say roughly 1100 AD, the Crusades, first Crusade started. By 1100, the European Crusaders had captured Jerusalem and a great deal of the coastline along Palestine and up into Syria. In 11, or roughly 1115, the Crusader castle of Shobek was founded by Baldwin I. This is an aerial view of it. If you haven't been to Shobek, it really is a site worth visiting. It's just off the road on the way to Petra, about maybe 20 kilometers before you get to Wadi Musa. This is not a very good photo, but from the ground looking up at Shobek, as you can see, it's really quite an imposing castle. Shobek was inhabited by the Crusaders, held by the Crusaders, until the very decisive defeat of the Crusaders in the Battle of Hattin in 1187. And within a year or so, Shobek was taken over by the Arabs. This is an aerial photograph Kerak. As you can see, from the air especially, you can understand why this was a very important strategic site, not only for the Crusaders, but going back into the Iron Age especially, when it was at one time the capital of Moab. This is the modern road that comes into Kerak, that you might be familiar with. Right here is where you pass the service stand and have every once in a while apples or tomatoes or cats thrown over the wall onto the cart. As you come around here, this is the road coming up by the rest house, and this is the Crusader castle right here. The castle of Kerak was established a little bit after the one at Chobeck, roughly around 1135, and fell about the same time as Chobeck did, that is, a year or so after the defeat of the Crusaders at Cap. Also, it's a little bit misleading when you go to Kerak and think that the entire castle is Crusader in base. The upper part of the castle is Crusader, but especially the other side where you enter the gate and walk down, a lot of that is later additions that were put on during the Ayyubid Mamluk period, from 1200 AD up until the Ottoman period around 1515. That's another shot across the Wadi looking back at Kerak showing the main Crusader part of the castle. Also, during the Crusader period, actually right about the end of the Crusader period, you had the construction of another medieval castle in Jordan, and that is the Ajlun Castle, or Castle Rabat. It is not, in fact, a Crusader castle, even though it comes from the Crusader period. It's built around 1185 by the cousin of Saladin. So it's an Arab castle with unique features of Arab architecture, although definitely built in the Crusader type of a pattern. Okay, following the ouster of the Crusaders, you find in the Ayyubid Mamluk, especially the Mamluk period, again, quite a boom period in Jordan. Especially in the Jordan Valley, you'll find sites like this, which is Tel Sukar, that there was a rapid increase, evidently, in agricultural activity, and it appears quite certain that one of the major crops of the Jordan Valley during this time, say roughly between 1300 AD until 1500 AD, that sugarcane was a main product. You find sugar mills and a lot of little sugar vats in this period. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of major monumental ruins from the Mamluk period, although there are sites scattered all over the place, especially in the southern Ghor. You'll find around Masra, Safi, Feifei, a number, and actually near Babi Grah itself, a number of Mamluk sites. Probably the most impressive monument from the Mamluk period is the castle at Aqaba, which is in fact very late in the Mamluk period, right around 1500 AD, just before the Turks took over. One thing that you'll find also, as I mentioned, the sugar mill that we saw at Tel Tsukar in the northern Jordan Valley, at Safi in the south. You also have Tawahin Azukar, which is also a sugar mill, probably dating to the Mamluk period. At least you find Mamluk pottery on the site. I'm not sure if anybody has ever really excavated or examined these particular ruins thoroughly enough to tell definitely that it is exclusively Mamluk or that it was perhaps built earlier and used in the Mamluk period. Again, one of the reasons for that is that there has been a tendency over the last 50 years or so for the archaeology of this region, more so in Palestine, but to a certain extent here in Jordan as well, to concentrate on the earlier so-called biblical periods. By the time you get into the Islamic period, people have a tendency to say, well, that's awful late, and in fact, you will find a lot of people questioning whether Mamluk material is really, are they really antiquities, because they're so recent, you know, they're only 400 or 500 years old. But that attitude is changing very rapidly now. Certainly here at Acor, we're getting more and more emphasis on the early prehistoric periods, before the Bronze Age, and also in the later Islamic periods. This is a nicely little preserved fortress from the Turkish or Ottoman period. dating, the autumn period runs from 1515 or 1516 up until the end of World War I, when the Turks are ousted and Jordan comes under the mandate. The Turks, the Ottomans, really didn't seem to have that much interest in Jordan. The main interest was because of the Hajjaj's route going down, the pilgrimage route to Mecca, and there were forts built along that pilgrimage route, which basically follows the desert highway, and then of course eventually the Hajjaj's railroad, which was so important during the First World War, was built along that same route. And you do find little forts like this along the desert highway or along the Hajjaj's railroad, which were guard posts to protect the pilgrims. This particular little castle is usually dated to around 1770 AD, and it's located at Katrana. And that's the end. We took this picture in 1977. It seems that you don't see very often, or at least if you're living in Amman, you don't see some of these beautiful full sky sunsets. But this was one that we noticed coming up on the desert highway, just about 40 kilometers south of Amman. Okay, let's go with the lights. It wasn't as short as I said. Okay, since B. Moore really isn't all that interested in what's coming next, I will try to go as quickly as possible, right, B? Now, in some of the previous lectures, especially Jerry Mattingly, he was talking, when he was discussing the surveys that have taken place in Jordan, he talked a lot about the early explorers. So I'm not going to go into that, but just to mention a few of the most important names in the early archaeological research in Jordan. One of them is certainly Ulrich Zetzen, or Zietzen, who was a German in this area around 1805 through 1807. So in those 2 years, he is generally credited with discovering both Jerash and Amman. Of course, I'm sure that some of the local inhabitants of the time would dispute his discoveries, but he certainly was an interesting character. As Jerry mentioned in his last lecture, it wasn't easy being an explorer in this part of the world, in Jordan, during the early 1800s. There was more exploration going on in the West Bank in Palestine, but Jordan, right up until 50 years ago, was kind of a wild and woolly place. In fact, when Zetzen finished his survey in 1907, he promptly returned to Jerusalem and died from some disease he had contracted while he was in the Dead Sea region. He has some very interesting, Zetzen does some very interesting descriptions, if you can get a hold of his publication, interesting descriptions of the locals around Kirak, and especially around Masra, how vicious these people are and how they're always getting waylaid by robbers. Another earlier explorer who made a tremendous contribution, especially since he was one of the first people to go around systematically collecting the Arabic place names of sites in Jordan, was Burckhardt, who was in this area from two Englishmen, Airby and Mangles, who were here in 1817 to 1818, are credited with the discovery of Arak el-Amir. As you remember, Jerry said that they were about the first two early explorers who didn't have great difficulty because they were military men and they were armed to the teeth. And so they did move through the country a little bit more freely than some of the earlier ones. The American Edward Robinson was here in 1838. Again, he was one of the most systematic surface explorers and also carrying on the work of Burckhardt, trying wherever he could to get the Arabic names for sites. One of the more controversial figures was a fellow by the name of de Salcy, and I'm not sure, I think that he's French. It's certainly a French name. He was around in 1863. His little volumes are really interesting and actually humorous reading. Everywhere de Salcy went, you'd swear he was seeing monuments, one site after another. He talks about the entire area around the Dead Sea as one gigantic ancient site. In fact, he goes from Safi all the way up to Mazra. Again, he's a biblical archaeologist looking for biblical sites, and he's called that area between Safi and Mazra Greater Zeboim, one of the five cities of the plain. You know, it's a stretch of about, probably 30 kilometers, and within that 30 kilometers you have sites ranging from the early Bronze Age right through to the late Islamic period. He saw all of those sites as being one big site, one big biblical site, I should say. So although a lot of the information that you get from these early explorers is valuable, but you've got to be very careful in how you evaluate their results. Some of it's much more reliable than others. A couple of comments just to show you what even contemporary scholars would say about de Salcy. I don't think I've heard of anybody who evokes more vehement reprimands from his colleagues than de Salcy did. De Salcy was one of the first to actually excavate. Most of these early explorers were just running around, spotting sites, writing down the names, and continuing on. In 1863, de Salcy did some excavations in Jerusalem at the Tomb of the Kings. It was a very simple, quick, I don't know how clean, but certainly quick operation, which just involved the clearance of the tombs of the king. And this is how H.J. Franken, who's excavated at Deir Allah, describes de Salcy's operation. He said it was cleared in the way that a sewer might be cleaned out today. He uses that image of a sewer, has something to say about what he thinks. Also, William Albright, who was probably one of the greatest American archaeologists of this century, at least in the early part of the century, has an interesting comment when he evaluates de Salcy. He says that of de Salcy that his enterprise exceeded his knowledge and his vanity exceeded both. So, and you could go on, there are statements like that throughout the literature evaluating de Salcy. Serious work in archaeology begins around 1865 when the Palestine Exploration Fund was set up and a young British officer by the name of Charles Warren was sent to Jerusalem to excavate. Now, Warren gets a lot of criticism because he had a very questionable practice which came to be known as tunneling. In fact, it's not a very acceptable practice, but you have to consider the fact that when Warren got to Jerusalem in the 1860s, he was looked upon with suspicion, not only by the Turkish authorities, but also by the local inhabitants. And that meant, first of all, that he wasn't able to excavate and open up large areas. In fact, the way he did most of his digging was trenching down right beside walls, digging great big pits, and usually in the middle of the night in order to avoid attracting attention. In fact, that's kind of backfired now. If archaeologists ever try to go out and dig at a site in the middle of the night these days, and this happened actually not that long ago, it creates more attention rather than escaping attention. But in any case, Warren did that, and then there was kind of a school of people that came along and did that. We've talked before about how an ancient tell is formed. If you're trenching and you want to get to the oldest thing, certainly the easiest way is to go straight down with a shaft or straight into the side. It's certainly a quick way to get at what you want to recover, especially if you're interested in the earlier material. It's also practically useless when you get the material out, because you can't see, you get all these artifacts out and you can't really see what relationship they are to anything else on the site. So as far as dating purposes, a lot of the work of the early tunnelers is almost worthless. Along with the early tunnelers, you do have guys like Pasalsi, whose excavation technique was simply to go in and blow a site out. We can be thankful that Pasalsi and these people didn't have bulldozers in those days, and we probably wouldn't have any ancient sites left in the Middle East. In fact, I might also add that that is one of the saving things for Jordan, since the early archaeologists were almost all exclusively biblical archaeologists. The big sites that had possible biblical identifications were the ones in which they concentrated on. Fortunately, most of the biblical sites are located in Palestine, or at least fortunately for Jordan, because Jordan was pretty much neglected by the early archaeologists for that very reason. Another very important name in the early period of archaeology is Sir Flinders Petrie, also a Brit, who is often referred to as the actual father of archaeology, or at least the father of modern archaeology. Petrie was originally, like most everybody else, a biblical scholar and an Egyptologist. Around 1885, he became interested in trying to clarify some of the biblical chronology, and the thing that he chose to concentrate on was trying to date the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and the conquest of ancient Canaan. And he felt that he had a chance of doing that, or at least a better chance than other people, because of his familiarity with Egyptology. His approach was that if he could go to Palestine and find objects at a Palestinian site which were similar to objects in well-dated context in Egyptian tombs, that he'd have a point of reference with which he could first begin to date biblical events. Some of his initial observations were very important. One was he noted how small Palestinian sites were, Jordanian sites. We referred to that before, most of them being just the size of a city block or so, as compared to Egyptian or Mesopotamian ancient sites. Also, although Schliemann had recognized this fact several decades earlier, Petrie was the first person really in Jordan-Palestine region to recognize that ancient sites or ancient tells are a buildup, an accumulation of debris, and that the earlier, or the deeper you dig, the earlier the period you run into. And in fact, Petrie, who started excavating in 1890 at Tel Hesi, which is near the coast and in the southern part of Palestine, was very fortunate in finding some artifacts that did have well-dated Egyptian parallels, and that, in fact, did give him some reference points. And it's just archaeologists since that time have simply been building up the number of artifacts with absolute dates, so that now we've got quite a reliable assemblage. Petrie is often referred to as a sequence digger, and the people who followed him as sequence diggers. And although a lot of his initial insights were very valuable, he made a few very definite mistakes. In other lectures we've mentioned this, but I should point out again. One of the mistakes was that Petrie thought that at all ancient sites there was a constant building up of deposition. Okay? So that all you had to do is dig at usually 50 centimeter intervals, and you could trust that as you were going down you'd be getting into earlier and earlier and earlier material. And of course the problem with that is that if in fact in a later period you get a pit that cuts all the way to the bottom, and you're assuming that as you come across the site and remove 50 centimeters and then 50 centimeters and keep on going down, that all of the material is going to be homogeneous and it's all going to be earlier. And in fact, if you haven't picked up this pit, which is of course filled with dirt, each level, every time you go across that pit, that's going to contaminate the material that you've got in your assemblage. Also, he assumed, or at least didn't take into account, the fact that you don't have continuous occupation. Therefore, he would come to one level that he was sure was Iron Age, and the next level he would come to would obviously have to be Persian, and the next level Hellenistic, and the next level Roman. Well, we know now it's a common phenomena that at the end of the Iron Age, a site will be abandoned, that there won't be any Persian period stuff there, there won't be any Hellenistic, and then it's reoccupied in the Roman period. So if you assume continuous occupation, don't take into consideration that the site may have been abandoned for a certain period, you'll end up being maybe 1,000 years off on dealing with a lot of your material. Again, one of the things that he also didn't take account of, not only pits, but the fact that if you're digging arbitrary levels and you're going straight across a site, you're assuming that in ancient times these different surfaces were completely level. And all you've got to do is walk out in front of our house here in the street, and you can see you can be walking along at one level and suddenly you drop into a hole that's contemporary. It may be much deeper. And that is, in fact, what you find on a site. You may be excavating up here and find a potsherd that's Roman in date, and 2 feet over here, 10 feet lower, you'll also find a Roman shirt. And they may both be in situ if, in fact, there was just a very rapid decline there, or a pothole in the street or something like that. So it's clear that you can't dig arbitrary levels. You have to follow the stratigraphy, which we'll talk about in just a second. Of the Americans in the early part of this century, William Albright, who was the director of the school in Jerusalem for a number of years, is probably the most important. He refined a lot of Petrie's work, but he also made a lot of the mistakes that Petrie did. One of the mistakes, or one of the things that Albright is often criticized for, is again, he was primarily a biblical scholar, and he had preconceived ideas about what he was looking for, and that very often influenced the interpretations that he came up with. He did move towards a little bit more careful stratigraphic excavation, but primarily his interest was not on the actual digging techniques. And I wish I had a film. I've got a film back in the States of the 1926 excavations at Tel Beit Mirsan, in which you see one or two supervisors and a mob of 250 workers, all with big picks and hoes, just digging away. And in those early days, an excavation by Albright would have removed probably about 50 times the amount of dirt that a normal excavation would move today. So it wasn't excavated very carefully, but the genius of Albright, and I don't know how he did it, nobody knows how he did it, was that he was a genius when it came to the study of ceramics. And it's largely due to those excavations of Tel Beit Mirsan that we get a start in sorting out the pottery, at least from the early Bronze Age through the Iron Age. He set up a typology that has certainly been refined in recent years on the basis of stratigraphic excavation, but it's amazingly reliable in light of the lousy excavation techniques that he was using at the time. Another fantastic thing about Albright was his mastery not only of the biblical material, but of ancient languages. I think he was really one of the last of these Leonardo da Vinci type fellows who was a master in a number of different fields. Although actual dirt excavation was not really one of his strong points. Certainly a contribution that he made was the fact that he began to view material and encouraged his students to view the material that was being found here in Palestine, not in isolation, but comparatively, compared to the material that was in Egypt and Anatolia and Mesopotamia and so forth. one other group that we class Albright in, basically at the tail end of the sequence digger, there's another group of archaeologists that are very often known as the architect or architecture archaeologist, which is very common at the first part of this century up until the end of the mandate around 1948. And these particular archaeologists had a tendency to concentrate on standing architecture and to date objects found within rooms on the basis of the architecture that surrounded them, but again, not paying very much attention to the actual stratigraphy. Of course, that can be very confusing when in fact you have one building that has a long period of use. You know, if you have a nice Iron Age structure, therefore you assume everything inside it must be Iron Age. If you aren't careful, you might find that that building was built in the Iron Age, but maybe used right up through the Hellenistic period. The real advances, as American, it's difficult for me to say, but the British really did lead the way in terms of introducing modern scientific stratigraphic excavation in Palestine and Jordan, and primarily through one person. You don't agree with that, Colin? No, we're getting over it. You know, thank you. But certainly Kathleen Kenyon, with her pioneering work at Jericho and Jerusalem, set the stage for improvements over this old approach to sequence digging. The sequence diggers did things basically in two dimension, whereas in stratigraphic excavation, careful attention is paid not only to the top plan, that is, where you find things within a room, but also the vertical dimension, so that whenever you find an important object, a pot or a glass bead or whatever, you triangulate that object and map it, not only its position within the room, but the actual depth at which it's found. So with the stratigraphic method, in theory at least, if you take your notes properly, making a drawing of the top plan every day and of your section at the end of the excavation, even though all you've got is a big hole, you should be able to flip through your notebook and reconstruct exactly every layer where it was found and every object within each one of those layers. Okay, we'll move on. Give me about two more minutes. I realize it's right now 7:30, but I want to talk very briefly about choosing a tell, and then we'll move on next time. One other problem that I'd like to draw attention to, and I wish this was a past problem, but it's one that still occurs, and again, it occurs primarily among the so-called biblical archaeologists, is that there has been this tendency to ignore the earlier stuff or the later stuff that you're not interested in. If you're a biblical archaeologist, you're primarily interested in material from the Iron Age through the Byzantine period, and certainly it was quite common 20 years ago for archaeologists to bring a bulldozer on the site and simply scrape away all of the Islamic occupation, perhaps even some of the Byzantine occupation, in order to get down quickly to the Iron Age occupation. That practice has been heavily criticized by the scholarly community, but it still, in fact, does go on in some places. Okay, choosing a tell, quickly. There's a variety of considerations that go into the selection of a tell or an ancient site that a person wants to excavate. The first one is often an interest in a specific period of history. Again, like maybe you're interested in the Iron Age. Hopefully you won't scrape away everything that's on the top. But in fact, more and more frequently, as we mentioned last time, people, if they have a particular interest in the Iron Age, they'll go out and try to find a one period Iron Age site so that they don't have to go through a lot of material that they're not particularly interested in. Secondly, some people are often interested in a particular problem. One example of that is at Tel Ramayth, it's a site up north of Irbit, was excavated by Paul Lapp in the early 70s. And the main reason he excavated that site was because very little known was known about Iron Age pottery, or the Iron Age pottery sequence for northern Jordan. And so that was a very specific goal that he had in putting down his soundings. Sometimes it's an attempt to date a particular structure, like Arak El Amir. Again, for years there was debate over the date of Arak El Amir, in fact, or the Kasr El Abed. There's still debate in spite of the excavations that have taken place. But Lapp, again, in the early 60s, went to Arak El Amir primarily just to put down soundings to determine the actual date that the building was founded, and if possible, the date that it was destroyed. It's becoming a thing of the past now, but certainly a few years ago, excavations were often mounted by museums, which were interested in increasing their collections. I think very fortunately for everybody, the countries of the Middle East have tightened up their antiquities laws so that not as many antiquities are flowing out of the country as was the case in the early years. But now you find that not only the Jordanians, but foreigners are finding that their museums are so full and their storerooms are so full that you find fewer and fewer museum sponsored projects that are coming over primarily for the aim of getting objects that can be put on display. Although you will notice when you evaluate all the projects that museums have ever sponsored that they have a tendency to sponsor projects that are working on ancient cemeteries rather than ancient settlement sites. Mm-hmm. Because you very seldom find whole pots on a settlement site, but you do recover them frequently from undisturbed graves. Sometimes you'll have a site chosen specifically for tourist purposes. The Jerash project right now is a good example of that. All of the excavation being financed by the government, primarily with an economic reason in mind to exploit the site for tourist purposes. Often you find that you don't choose the site, but the site gets chosen for you when you get in one of these salvage operations, and you get a call and you've got to go dig a site within a few days. Unfortunately, some archaeologists or explorers choose their sites because they're looking for treasure, or they're looking for biblical relics, or they're looking for notoriety. One of the most notorious examples of this was about a year ago when we had a group here claiming that they had found the Ark of the Covenant. In fact, it was a big scam, but they got an awful lot of publicity throughout the United States and Europe for their alleged discovery, and I'm sure that they got a lot of little old ladies listening to the revival hour on Sunday morning sending you the money, because that was his big appeal, that he needed a lot of money now to come back to Jordan to excavate this Ark of the Covenant. And one final thing, the reason or the way in which a person picks a site, I think it's very important, maybe often overlooked. Paul Lapp points out in his little book, The Tell of the Tale, always mess that up, The Tale of the Tell. He defines archaeology as a love affair between an archaeologist and an ancient ruin. I think to no small extent, the reason that certain archaeologists pick a certain tell is that there is a certain love affair there. And it's, I won't go through that, but you might want to read in Lapp's book his brief descriptions about how, in a lot of ways, a tell is like a woman. You know, she has her secrets, she has certain dimensions, she's forthcoming and withdrawn and so forth. Well, okay, we'll pick up this up.
Wait, so effective.